Okay. So, one thing
left over from last time is a simple fifth counterexample to show that L infinity convergence, which is the same as uniform convergence almost everywhere, does not imply pointwise convergence, because almost everywhere just doesn't imply everywhere in general. Right? So, you have a function, a sequence of functions, where the nth function is just going to be zero everywhere except on input zero, right? Where it'll say do something bad, right? Like go off to infinity. So make it equal to n if the input is zero, and otherwise for any other real input, any non-zero real input, the output is zero. But on zero, you output n. So, obviously, the sequence f sub n now does not converge to the zero function point-wise, since if you plug in zero, the limit is infinity. On the other hand, any of those almost everywhere convergence notions, you got it. The nicest one, uniform, almost everywhere, you got it. It's also called L infinity. Right? In fact, for all n, the L infinity norm of Fn is just zero, right? Because you can exclude a measure zero set, namely singleton zero, and outside of that set, the function is zero. The sequence of functions uniformly converges to zero almost everywhere because the sequence of functions is the zero function for all n almost everywhere. It's just the zero function over and over and over again, but modified on a null set. So that's probably the least interesting of the five counterexamples, but I thought I really needed to throw in that fifth counterexample for completeness. I have a complete demonstration of how you can't add any more implications to the diagram without making additional assumptions. Okay. So I want to set up that. You all have any questions? I know what's up next is section 1.6, but I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about 1.5 or older stuff first. Did you have a question about the lower board?
I mean, the norm. And by definition, I mean.
Yeah?
What's the definition, I mean?
The definition of what?
I mean, the definition is the. In the area, the biggest one. The definition. I mean the f.
That's the function.
I mean this
zero.
No. F. I mean
that
this norm. This norm is the.
The L infinity norm.
Yeah, I mean the norm is the. Biggest number of this area.
The L infinity norm is the best upper bound you could get on the function's outputs by excluding a null set of inputs.
Okay.
It's the infimum, which in this particular example happens to be the same as the minimum. over taken over all sets of measure zero. So in this case, we're talking about things with Lebesgue measure zero. And then you want to say, well, what kind of upper bounds, what are the best, i.e. lowest upper bounds I can get on the function? So I just look at the supremum. For any given exclusion set, you can look at the supremum of the set of all x. In this case, it's one-dimensional, so reals x that are not in the null exclusion set.
Okay.
So, and you take the supremum of all the magnitudes of the outputs f of x. And as we talked about last time, this infimum is attained in the sense that there's actually some null sets out there that actually will give you this number. Other questions? Talk about the differentiation chapter 1.6. So what's going on with this chapter is, in the spirit of Littlewood's three principles, what were Littlewood's three principles, right? You could approximate a Lebesgue measurable set by an open set, in a certain sense. If it had finite Lebesgue measure, then you could even approximate it by a finite union of intervals. Right? Or in higher dimensional cases, a finite union of boxes. Right? And then there are two more principles. Let me get the first principle on the board. Lebesgue measurable sets are approximately open. Sets with finite Lebesgue measure are approximately elementary, right? Approximately finite unions of boxes. Then the second principle was that functions in L1, meaning functions whose integrals of their four parts are all finite, or equivalently
whose integrals of their magnitudes are all finite. Approximately continuous. Now, which L1? I mean, in all that abstract stuff we did in section 1.4, you know, for any measure space, there's the associated set of L1 functions. So if we want to be precise here, we're talking about L1 for Euclidean space and for a Lebesgue measure. And then the third principle was that there was like Urgaroth's theorem was an instance of it, that you could get by throwing away a set of small measure, you could make pointwise convergence uniform. These cases, you have to have to make this actual useful mathematics, right? You have to spell out your notion of approximation, right? A Lebesgue measurable set is approximately open in the sense that it has an open superset with at most epsilon extra measure, right? And you're free to choose what the epsilon is. Given any epsilon, you can get an open superset with the most epsilon extra measure. If the set has infinite Lebesgue measure, right, what that means is that the extra stuff, right, the leftover stuff, has measure epsilon. So you have to be careful and be precise and say the measure of the leftover points by passing to an open superset is less than epsilon. Finite measure case, you can approximate an open set, you know, within measure epsilon by just a finite union of intervals, but it may not be enough to just do a superset. You may have to throw away some points. So this approximately elementary thing is a little bit weaker. It says, okay, given any epsilon, I can given a finite measure set and an epsilon, I'll throw away, say, epsilon 2 measure of points and add another set of points of measure epsilon over 2, and the result will be elementary.
Renee.
Sir, I'm here.
Welcome.
I just landed.
Brave man.
That's promissory.
All right.
Sorry for being this late, but I just came in from San Antonio.
Wow. Okay.
I'm just reviewing Littlewood's three principles here. And this second notion, you can approximate it in one way using Lewson's theorem, and another way you can approximate it is with just taking the actual L1 distance between the functions, where you just integrate the magnitude of the difference.
So you have a continuous function,
and then you can look at the magnitude of its difference with some given L1 function. And the idea is for a given epsilon, you can pick the continuous function such that the integrated magnitude of differences between the continuous function and the L1 function is under epsilon. That's one way of doing this. Thank you. And in fact, you can not only get it continuous, you can get what's called, you know, continuous and compactly supported. We'll talk about that today. Okay. So this one is very relevant to us today.
Because chapter 1.6, or section 1.6, whatever you call it, is all about stuff you can do with L1 functions.
Big thing is Lebesgue differentiation theorem. Okay, so this, and then what am I saying here? I'm saying I can get this continuous compactly supported function to approximate that given L1 function epsilon well, in the sense of integrating all the differences but taking magnitude, so that it's not that there's some kind of cancellations where some places G is an overestimate, some places is an underestimate, and that somehow cancels out to make it smaller than epsilon. I'm saying no, just take the magnitudes of the differences.
In general, if these are complex valued functions, you know, think of it as like taking a point in the complex plane and rotating it so that it's now on the positive real ray.
But still same distance from zero. So no cancellations, but still total difference in some sense, small.
Yeah. Can anybody tell me what compactly supported means?
Well, supported means that there are values above than zero. Compactly is the one that I don't get.
So basically, if it's, you know, anything supported, if it's gorbly supported, then that means it's supported on a gorb set. Okay?
Okay.
So in this case, compactly supported means supported on a compact set. And supported usually means something like outside of this set, the function is zero.
Okay. That's, sometimes people will say something like, well, you take the
closure of all the places where the function is non-zero, and that's the support.
But however you want to define it, compact sets, at least in Euclidean space, are all closed, so it won't matter. So
then, how do we understand a compact set?
Well, compact sets, in the context of Euclidean space, compact just means closed and bounded.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, in fact...
Okay. Where there's an interval, and this interval is closed on both sides.
Yes. Now, if you have a closed interval and then you delete some open interval, say, you might end up with then a union of two closed intervals. And that would still be a closed set and bounded. Mm-hmm. Closed is more general than just for intervals.
Right? I see.
Yeah.
So this just says that... in terms of there exists a K compact subset of Euclidean space such that what? So we're just saying that everything outside of K is going to be stuff where the function is zero. That's the compactly supported part, and then of course also G is continuous. That's the continuous part. So the big C is for continuous, little c is for compactly supported.
So you need that principle. You need that principle.
This, Basically, if you remember all those seven modes of convergence, one of them was almost uniform.
Okay. And that said, excluding a set of measure epsilon, the sequence converges uniformly. So basically, there are abstract measure spaces that are not as nice as the Lebesgue measure spaces. Okay. And so, if you go back, it's towards the end of 1.5, there's addition, you can have an additional convergence.
Basically, the restriction, I found the reference, is in the 1.4 version of it, you need, it's a little bit more general, but you still need an additional assumption. You need
the holes, you need all of those functions to be zero outside of a set of finite measure, and then you can actually get pointwise implies almost. Throw away a set of inputs of measure epsilon. I mean, of course, you have to choose that set, not just any set, but there's for any epsilon, there's some set of measure most epsilon where you throw that set away, and then on the other inputs, the sequence of functions converges uniformly. There's all these.
This requires some little restriction there. And there's other versions of this principle for Lebesgue measure.
The focus for 1.6 is really on this one.
Another way of stating this is that the compactly supported continuous functions on Euclidean space are dense in the amidst the L1 functions.
And by the way, this is in general here we're talking about complex valued functions. That's how the L1 space is defined. Okay, technically I need the additional thing where the function has to be Lebesgue measurable too. Otherwise it doesn't make sense to do a Lebesgue integral for it. Boards are full. I'm going to take some pictures. So, in the spirit of Littlewood's three principles, I can tell you that for L1 functions that are, say, real valued, the first fundamental theorem of calculus is almost true. What's the first fundamental theorem of calculus? I'll keep that board now. So I can get something new on the top board here.
Is that where we have the formal definition of a limit, sir? Is that the fundamental theorem of calculus?
A theorem is not a definition.
Okay.
So the fundamental theorems of calculus, there's two of them, and what they say is that derivatives and integrals undo each other, right?
Ooh, okay. I didn't realize that's a fundamental theorem, but I always just accepted it as true. So I believe it.
Well.
Then what's the other fundamental theorem, sir?
The second fundamental theorem. The second fundamental theorem, you know, when you have to do a definite integral, you take the antiderivative, then you plug in the limits of integration and take the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the second fundamental theorem. It says you can do that.
Isn't the first one like, I mean, if I recall it in symbols, it's like capital F prime of x equals to the integral from zero to x of f. No, it's, okay, no, it's the other one. It's little f of x equals integral from 0 to x of capital F prime of x dx, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the first fundamental theorem of calculus says that you can do an integral and then by varying the upper limit, you get yourself an actual function, and the claim is that then taking the derivative of that function will get you back to the function you started with. Okay. But you need some assumptions in there to make it work. The usual thing that's proved in the calculus textbook is that if the function is continuous, then you can take an integral, then take a derivative, and you're back where you started. This stuff will generalize really easily to the complex valued case, because with derivatives, what do? You take the derivative of the real part,
take the derivative of the imaginary part. You do it, it's totally separate. So you don't really get anything new and interesting
by just talking about the derivatives in this context. I mean,
you take our complex variables course, you see some more advanced stuff about how you can make derivatives for complex numbers more interesting. But the point is, in that, you have to have a complex input, right? Having a complex output doesn't make the derivatives any more interesting. If your inputs are still, you know, Euclidean, like just reals or R to the D, right? Then the derivative concept is not that fancy, right? Especially here, it's just a one-dimensional kind of input. So having a complex valued output would just really be the same as having two real valued functions. Nothing exciting there. So, okay, so it's continuous, and what? And how do we cook up the new function? This way. Start at the left end point of the domain, A, and go to x and integrate the function from A to x. Then we claim that for all x in the interval, the derivative of the new function is the old function. That's the first fundamental theorem of calculus. Do an integral, undo it with a derivative. Now, of course, there is a limit hidden in that prime, right? This says that the limit as h approaches 0 of g of x plus h minus g of x over h is equal to little g of x. And to handle the left end point and the right end point, you have to make an additional restriction, which is you only consider x plus h in the interval, right? I mean, in general, if you have a function, like here's, say g looks like this, okay? If you want to compute the derivative at A, right, you have to look at points to the right of A and compute the slope between those two points and then bring that point closer and closer. So you have to use a right-hand derivative at A. Likewise, at B, you have to use a left-hand derivative. If you're in the interior, then your left-hand and right-hand derivatives have to equal each other in the limit, right? So the difference between them should go to zero as h goes to zero. So if you want to be picky about what's happening at the endpoint, you have to put a little additional restriction here, right? That's how you do. So that's it. Could you prove that, by the way?
No.
No.
There's some
deep facts kind of under the surface, like.
You really end up using a property of compactness of the, right? The fact that this is compact is essential because it gives you something called uniform continuity, right? If a function has compact domain, and the function is continuous, then it's uniformly continuous, which allows us to do some delicate epsilonics, right?
Sir, are you saying that the words uniformly continuous means compactly continuous and
no, compactly continuous is not a concept. I've never heard that, but
okay.
I'm saying that the conjunction of a compact domain and continuity implies uniform continuity.
Okay, sir. A way to understand.
Yeah.
Okay, sir.
Okay, so let's see. As you know, I like to abbreviate stuff. Okay. What does this mean? It means for all x in the domain of f, for all epsilon greater than 0, there exists a delta greater than 0 such that for all y in the domain of f, if the distance between x and y is less than delta, then the distance between the outputs is less than epsilon. So this says, okay, for any x and epsilon, we can find a delta. So uniform continuity, stronger.
DOM of F again?
The domain.
A domain, all right. Sir.
The set of all inputs.
Yes, sir.
In this example, the domain is just the closed interval from A to B. So here the delta has to work for all the x in the domain at the same time. Whenever the for all comes after the existential, that means you have to get the delta to work for all of these at the same time. So obviously like here, it doesn't depend on the y. Okay, so that wasn't clear. And here, it doesn't depend on either the x or the y. So. So if you want to prove the fundamental theorem of calculus, the first one, just hit it with the uniform continuity. Right? Okay. So here's what we do. We just need to show this limit thing here. Okay? But let's expand out what does limit mean here. It would mean that's where we're going. Why did I say, okay, given an epsilon? Well,
if you read out what a limit means, this limit means for every positive epsilon, there exists a delta, right? Such that for all h smaller than delta, right? If x plus h is in the domain, then this difference quotient is epsilon close to the little g of x. Given an epsilon, I'm going to need to find a delta that does that for me. And now, I don't have to use the same delta for all x, but it actually works out that I think you actually can. I think you can get away with that. See what I mean? So, there's this fact. Compact domain of a continuous function implies the function is uniformly continuous. There's another deep fact, which is that this also implies that the range of f is compact. The set of all outputs, which means that the set of all outputs is bounded. Okay. So there's some number m such that f's outputs will always be between negative m and positive m. So that's how I can get some control here. I can do a number of things. I can have, so at the start here, let's just have the function vary less than epsilon in output when it varies less than varies less than delta input. Okay. Now let's look at our difference quotient here. So I'm going to let some h. And let's just call y the x plus h, okay? And I want to show it's kind of epsilon estimate, okay?
let's look at this. This is the integral from a to x plus h, little g, minus the integral of the same function from a to x. So the difference between these functions is just the integral from x to x plus h. What I want to do now is I want to put absolute values on everything because I'm, not quite yet, but right here, how much can g of t change from g of x as t goes from x to x plus h? Well, it can't change by very much. And depending on whether h is positive or negative, you may have to consider either of these intervals. But either way, the function will not change by epsilon on this domain of integration here. Because you're so close. The h is smaller than delta. Okay. It'll get the board a little higher now. So we have underestimates now and overestimates. We have an underestimate and an overestimate. This g of t will always be between g of x plus epsilon and g of x minus epsilon. So basically, I'm approximating this function by constant functions. I just take the value at the left endpoint, add and subtract an epsilon. That's my underestimate. And then my overestimate comes from here. And it's supposed to be, it's dt's for all of them, okay? So integrating with respect to t, I mean, this never changes. So it's just going to be this value times the length of the domain, right? Height times width. Width h, height g of x minus epsilon.
So do you intend to write the integral of x to x plus h and then parentheses g of x minus epsilon dt, not g of t?
Yes, that's my intent. My point is that if you look at the value at the left endpoint at x, then since you're only going to x plus h, it's a very short interval, okay?
Okay.
It's so short that the function does not change by epsilon. The changes are all smaller than epsilon, okay? So that's the uniform continuity being used, right? For every t in this interval, I know that the outputs are less than epsilon apart when I compare the output at t to the output at the endpoint x. Right? I had a single delta that did that for me. And that's where I use the uniform continuity, because I need this delta to work for all of those t's, not just different deltas for different t's.
So it's almost like you're saying if epsilon is small, h is even smaller.
Well, it doesn't have to be small, just small enough, right? I mean, You can make it small, because generally speaking, smaller is better here.
So then if epsilon is small enough, then h is smaller?
Basically, for any epsilon, no matter how small, we need to do this.
Okay.
And so if the epsilon given to us is really small, that's the way to think about it. Think about it. Somebody can give you an epsilon. You have no control over it except that it's a positive real. And then you have to be able to do this. You have to find the delta. Right. So you just find the delta that's small enough to do the job. If you find a delta that works, any smaller delta would also work. Just find one that's small enough. For some functions, it's trivial because the function is constant or something. Any delta you want would work. But in general, you might have to make the delta really, really small. Think of it like if the function is really steep, then delta would have to be really small compared to epsilon. If the function is really shallow and small slope, then even a big delta might be good enough. This is good because, see the, now if you look at the difference quotient, right, what are we going to do? We're going to divide by h, subtract off a g of x. Okay, so what happens over here? Divide by an h, subtract off a g of x, what do you got? Negative epsilon. And over here, you divide by h, subtract the g of x off, you'll have positive epsilon. Now, if h is negative, the division by h could flip the inequalities around. But either way, you're going to have a negative epsilon on one side and a positive epsilon on the other.
Voila, you got an absolute value.
Yep. I guess one other technicality is don't divide by zero. So when you're doing your difference quotient, but yeah. But that aside, yeah, it's all good. My apologies to those of you who think that this is all, you know, old review from undergraduate.
In my gratitude to those, I think it's helping me. I forgot a lot of this.
And even this proof, right? I mean, it's very much not self-contained, right? Okay. You know what? There's one part. Or I guess I was wrong. I thought I was going to need the boundedness, but I didn't actually use that. Right? I just used the uniform continuity. Sometimes I get mixed up in which proofs need what. So. But all I actually used was the implication to uniform continuity. So you have to, if you want to, you know, have a complete self-contained proof, you'd have to look up, you know, a proof for that. Or you would have to strengthen the hypothesis and say, assume the G is uniformly continuous.
But what do we do in grad school?
We try to take this proof and we try to see how much of it is still true in a more general sense, in, say, L1 functions. What can we still get, you know, this to be true? The Lebesgue differentiation theorem says, yes, you can get it to be true, except on a set of reals of measure 0. If you're willing to throw away a null set, then for any L1 function defined on the real line, not just a continuous function, first fundamental theorem of calculus is still true. And to prove it, you do stuff like this. It involves approximating L1 functions by continuous functions, where we have the first fundamental theorem of calculus. And we use lots and lots of approximations, and you put them all together, and in the end you conclude that, yes, you can get a function, any L1 function has an antiderivative almost everywhere. Now, there's no way I'm going to do that proof in the remainder of this lecture if it took me that long to do the classical proof. So, rather, let me tell you, I'll state it, I'll put it on the board, and I'll give you an example of how you can use it. Okay. Well, I may as well keep L1 there since it's about L1 functions. I'm just going to state the one-dimensional version, okay? Let me put it this way. I want it to be real value. Technically, this is complex value, so I want to look. Think of it as I threw away the imaginary part. Otherwise, I would. Basically, the real part has an antiderivative almost everywhere, and the imaginary part has an antiderivative almost everywhere in general. And the union of two null sets is null, so after throwing away a big enough null set, still null, you could have the real and imaginary part both having antiderivatives. So let's just assume it's real. And then here's how we form the function. In probability theory, they call this kind of move where you hold the lower endpoint fixed and you vary the upper endpoint of the integral. They call this operation the cumulative distribution. So you'll have a probability density function, and this kind of integral is what they call the cumulative distribution. Very confusing, because then they're always talking about PDFs and CDFs. Okay, so what do we do here? Well, we're just going to go all the way to negative infinity, right? Lebesgue integrals can handle infinities really well, right? Formally, we defined a Lebesgue integral over the whole real line. So what this really means is integrate over the real line and truncate the function horizontally. That is, apply the indicator function for negative infinity to t. Negative infinity to t? Supposed to be an x. So if t is less than or equal to x, this will spit out f of t. little f of t. If t is greater than x, then it's going to spit out 0. That's how you generalize the Lebesgue integral to this kind of thing. I mean, in general, you can use an indicator function for any Lebesgue measurable set to talk about the integral of a function on that set. So then we say, so then there exists a bad set E, but it has Lebesgue measure 0, really small. Okay. Total length 0 is how you should think about it geometrically. Really sparse in some sense. And once we make sure we're not on the bad set, then capital F is actually differentiable at x. Right. And the derivative at x equals little f of x. That's Lebesgue's differentiation theorem. I think it's 1.6.11 in the book. Now.
Okay. Now, I can give you an application of this. It's a very simple application. In some sense, it's using a chainsaw to cut a shoelace. But it's an example.
Here's a question. Could you have a set of reals such that if you restricted it to any interval, half the reals were in the set and half were not? Okay. I claim that you can't have that. I need the extra hypothesis that's Lebesgue measurable. Okay. So I claim that there's if you just restrict A to some interval. I claim you can choose the interval such that this is not equal to half the measure of the interval. And of course, the measure of the interval is just the length of the interval. Right? So I claim that you can't. I think Tao might use the word like clumpy or something. You can prove this using approximations by elementary sets. One way to do it. Two is to use Lebesgue's differentiation theorem. So what's your function going to be? Well, your function, which will be Lebesgue measurable, will just be, you know, an indicator function for A. Well, you don't want the integral to go to infinity. Well, okay. Just truncate it somehow, okay? How about we truncate it between 0 and 1? So I'll have to find my A and B between 0 and 1. Okay. So for almost all x in here, right? This is a set of measure 1, and excluding some set of measure 0, I'm going to have that this this kind of accumulation function is going to have derivative little f of x. Now, what does this have to do with this? Well, think about how the Lebesgue integral is defined. Okay. So let's look at this. We would have, I mean, our function is just an indicator function for a measurable set, so it's actually a simple function. So it's just a simple integral. So let's think about this. What is f of x? F of x is the following. We integrate, since I'm restricting to 0 to 1, it's really just an integral now from 0 to x, okay, of little f of x. And by cutting it to 0, cutting it off of 0, this is actually just the indicator function of a. So this is a function that always has height 1, and total length is just the measure of A. But restricted to this interval. Assuming the x is between 0 and 1. And remember why I did the truncation. The truncation was to have it be an L1. Okay, now. Now let's do a derivative. So you have A truncated to this interval, take away A truncated to that smaller interval. Okay, so the total length, you can write it like this. So what do we have? It's going to be the measure of A intersected with, it's just, the difference between the two intervals is this interval. And h is the measure of that interval, right? That's its length. I guess here I'm just doing the right-hand derivative, say. All right. The fact that it's got the two-side derivative in particular means it has the right-hand derivative. Okay, now what is this? Well, if we have... this should come out to be, if this was true for all AB, then this would be a half, right? Okay. But I claim that this can't be a half in general, because in the limit, this is supposed to be f of x for almost all x. But f of x is always either 0 or 1, right? It's just an indicator function. Okay. So that if this was really, if this was true for all a and b, right? If this ratio here was really, you know, a half, if a really had half the reals of every interval, this would be a half.
The indicator function is always 0 or 1.
So this tells you that if you do have a set of reals that in some sense has half of every interval, then it's not a Lebesgue measurable set. It's something you cooked up in some weird way with the axiom of choice.
LDT stand for, use LDT.
Oh, I love to abbreviate.
We've got Lebesgue differentiation theorem.
All right, sorry, sir.
That's okay.
Not to be confused with the LDCT, Lebesgue's dominated convergence theorem from 1.4. But you can just call that one DCT. It's okay. Lebesgue will forgive you. Okay.